Rema Rifat Elarir, her two-month-old baby boy, and her husband, just killed in Israeli airstrike. Jihad Abu Salim is a scholar and policy analyst from Gaza. He's executive director of the Jerusalem Fund. That does it for our broadcast. To see the poem Rifat Elarir wrote, If I Must Die, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey everyone, I'm Shay from Planned Parenthood. Here are some fast facts about abortion. Abortion is really common. Chances are you know someone who's had an abortion. In the United States, about 1 in 4 women will have one by the age of 45. Abortion is extremely safe. Abortion is safer than getting your tonsils out or your wisdom teeth pulled. And abortion doesn't increase your risk of cancer, infertility, mental health issues, or any other health problem. The majority of people who get abortions are already parents. 59% of people who have had abortions have had at least one childbirth experience. Most people in the U.S. think abortion should be legal by a wide margin. 80% of Americans want abortion to remain legal, even in states where politicians pass laws against abortion. For more information, visit PlannedParenthood.org.
And you're listening to radio station WUSB in Stony Brook, broadcasting at 90.1 FM and 107.3 FM. And also over the internet at WUSB.FM. The time is 6 o'clock. It's a Tuesday evening. Can only mean one thing. It's off the wall time. And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you, joined by Kyle.
On occasion.
On occasion, yes, definitely. Holding things down and, yeah, just keeping an air of sanity around here because we sure need that. And there's a lot going on. We're going to be talking about it. We're going to try to talk about it in the hour that we have. Still recovering from driving across the damn country to see the eclipse, but happy to be back. And, yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything that... there's been news out of Austin, Texas, where we were. Austin is a really interesting city. If you've never been there, suggest going there. A lot of individuality, a lot of free spirits out there. But right now, a lot of activity on campus as students do what students are known to do, and that's protest things when injustice rears its ugly head. We'll talk about that in a little while. Yeah, I think we pretty much covered everything that we did on the way back. I know we went we drove through Miami Beach. That was fun. Washington D.C. We talked about the sitting in on Congress, and yeah, I guess that's pretty much it. It's, you know, I recommend it. I recommend driving cross country at some point in your life and just, you know, not stressing about it too much. Yeah, I was thinking today that when you're driving on a highway, it's like you're in this community of people, and you keep passing the same people, or they keep passing you, and you kind of develop this camaraderie. And it's a hard thing to describe, but I know when I was doing some of the driving between Texas and Florida through the Deep South and all that, you kind of want to make sure everybody gets where they're going safely, and you feel the same coming from them. It doesn't matter, you know, what your background is, what your beliefs are, anything like that. None of that matters. You're fellow travelers together on a highway. It's weird, but there is this kind of partnership that builds. And you realize when you're driving, it's not just about you keeping your car safely distanced from other cars. But it's kind of like it's this massive geometry type game where, okay, so now you move out of the middle lane, and that means 18-wheeler behind you has enough space so that he's not crowding somebody right in front of him, and of course, that person takes the space, and you're kind of like you're setting up this playing field. And if you do it right, everybody is in a good place, and nobody's angry at each other. So when you get back to Long Island, you realize, oh boy, this place needs work. People have to calm down a bit and not be on each other's tail constantly and looking out for one another. So you're driving right now, the person in front of you, protect them. Watch out for the person next to you. They might not see what you see. You know, we're all in this together. And I'm sure somewhere there's some kind of a parallel between, you know, society and the highway. There has to be.
Yeah, like this sort of universal courtesy that you extend, and it in turn allows everyone to get to where they want to be.
Courtesy is contagious, Kyle. It's the first great pandemic. People don't talk about that, but yeah, courtesy. Try it out. Okay, good news today. Let's just get this over with. Get the good news out of the way quickly. Justice Department plans to forward a recommendation for easing restrictions on marijuana to the White House in what could amount to a major change in federal policy. That's according to three people familiar with the matter. I love the way the story is written. It comes from the New York Times. And the way the story ends is the Associated Press earlier reported the decision. Like, you know, okay, you guys, you get the credit for reporting the story for all time. Even though this is our own story that we wrote here, we're still going to give a nod to you at the very end of the story. But yeah, the Justice Department supposedly is going to forward a recommendation. I don't know how they're going to forward it, whether it's going to be by, you know, email or postal, or just somebody's going to walk over to the White House. But, yeah, this is big. Now, the move, which if approved, would kick off a lengthy rulemaking process, would not end the criminalization of the drug. I don't know why they can't do that. It would be a significant shift in how the government views the safety and use of marijuana for medical purposes. So that's something, I guess. It could also lead to the softening of other laws and regulations that account for the use and possession of cannabis, including sentencing guidelines, banking, and access to public housing. Okay, so maybe finally all these dispensaries can use the federal banking system, you know, instead of having to cart cash around everywhere or just be completely awkward about it. Maybe you can use your credit card in a dispensary. Wouldn't that be nice? Anyway, one person familiar with the recommendation, speaking on the condition of anonymity, said the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, would tell the White House Office of Management and Budget today, at some point, that the government should change the drug's classification. What, is that it? He's just going to go over there and say, hey, you know what, you should do this. I hope it's more than that. I hope it's more formal. As many of us know, for more than 50 years now, marijuana has been considered a so-called Schedule... Is this a Schedule 1 drug, Kyle, or a Schedule I drug? Because it's the letter I.
Yeah, but that would be a numeral.
So all of a sudden we're in Roman numerals and we're talking about Schedule...
I believe that is the way they're saying it, but it is 1.
Okay, that's what I thought, but this is quite clearly an I, so I was a little confused.
Certainly, either would mean the same thing in this case, and that scheduling change is what we're talking about here.
Okay, so a Schedule I drug...
It seems simple.
Schedule 1 drug,
yeah,
classified on the same level as highly addictive substances like heroin, that the Drug Enforcement Administration describes as having no currently accepted medical use. Heroin has no currently accepted medical use. Make that into a PSA. Yeah, people need to know this. Now, last year, the Health and Human Services Department recommended to the DEA that marijuana should be a Schedule III drug. Oh, yeah, look at that. They do Roman numerals for some reason. Okay, so marijuana should be a Schedule III drug. All right, and that's as of last year, that's what they recommended, which would put it alongside less addictive substances like Tylenol with codeine or ketamine and testosterone. Wait, I thought we made our own testosterone. You can get testosterone in a bottle? All right. Meaning it would be subject to fewer restrictions on production and research and that it could be taken with a prescription. And that's that. Good news, right? That's good news. You happy?
Yeah, it's more in line with how it is used and the types of barriers to further progress.
But why can't they
with regard to research and other stuff, I think is really, really important.
Why can't they just decriminalize it? Why can't they just, I mean, isn't that what they did in Canada? It's decriminalized, so, all right, maybe this is a step in that direction. Maybe next year, after Biden wins, he'll say, yeah, you know what, let's just decriminalize the whole thing, and that'll be that?
There's a huge step in that direction.
Okay, this is a huge step.
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, I'll take that. That makes me feel better. I just wish it was more of a step, but I think that's the theme of what we talk about every week is that, yeah, we're taking steps, but not big enough steps.
Well, the severity of penalties versus also the things that aren't that aren't going on like research,
mm-hmm,
and it being seen as a source of actual benefit to people medically speaking, those are big gaps that aren't out there, the banking thing you mentioned, all those things.
Now, I just wonder, you know, we just traveled through Mississippi and Alabama and places like that where it's very illegal recreationally. So I just wonder, does this make it easier on people that have it recreationally in those states where it's forbidden? And I suspect it's not going to make things much easier for them because the state laws are still going to be pretty harsh and people could still go to prison for having pot. You know, if they don't have a prescription for it. So, I don't know. I could be wrong on that, but I don't see that mentioned here.
Yeah, the overall impact as it becomes, like, local, you do run into those kind of penalties. But the federal statutes and the way it is written with the scheduling system sets the tone, you know, in a big way, even if the states may have, like, harsher penalties.
Yeah. Well, it's progress. It's definitely a step. Another bit of progress is happening in New York State concerning elections. Unfortunately, here on Long Island, I may have mentioned this a couple of times in the past, we're moving in the wrong direction. We're going the opposite way that I think we should be going, the opposite way that other parts of the state are going, other parts of the country. Yeah, and now that we've gone and elected a Republican to be county executive, you can count on more backwards thinking. Suffolk County and Hempstead Town have followed Nassau County in suing Governor Kathy Hochul and New York State over, ready for this? A change that will allow more people to vote. Yeah, not dead people, not people from other countries, not aliens. People who are registered to vote. Now, what is this about? Okay, most local elections take place right now in odd years. Not much else happens in odd years. So very few people show up. Very few people vote. By moving those elections to even years, starting in 2026, guess what happens? More people show up because they're voting for bigger offices. President, governor, senators, and congressmen, and all that. Guess who's upset by that? Guess who's always upset when more people turn out to vote? Republicans, because when more people turn out to vote, Republicans lose. That is a fact. That just happens all around the country. And that's why you always see Democrats trying to make voting easier, trying to make it so that more people are able to vote, and of course, meaning people who are eligible to vote. And that's why you always see Republicans fighting that, tooth and nail. Well, okay, so Suffolk, Hempstead, and people in Jefferson County upstate, right-wing fascist guy, Nassau County Executive Bruce Blakeman, they all filed lawsuits to stop this. Now, Republicans have been criticizing this change statewide, saying voters will ignore local issues when local elections coincide with federal and state elections. Okay, I'm trying to follow that logic. Okay, let's think about this for a second. So, you're saying that when people show up to vote, and more people show up to vote, because there are other issues, such as federal elections, state elections, while you're there at the poll, you're going to say, yeah, you know what? I don't care about local elections. I'm only here to vote for federal elections and state elections. Yeah, there's another line on the ballot, but I'm just going to skip over that and go back outside. Really? You think that's going to happen? You're there at the polling place. You're voting. Why would you stop voting? Why would you only half vote? Why would you vote for state elections then? Why not just federal? Or maybe you're a state's right person, and you just vote for state's issues and skip the federal election. Maybe we should have a different election day for every single decision. Maybe that's how we do it. No. Democrats say local elections should coincide with gubernatorial and presidential contests when turnout is highest. Now, as I said, Democrats historically have better turnout during gubernatorial and particularly presidential years. Yeah, sucks, I know. It's too bad. More people prefer the other side than your side. Imagine that. And in a democracy, what that means is that the other side would win. I know it's a real leap in logic, but that's kind of what is being pushed here. You know, majority rule. It's not the worst thing in the world. Maybe we should try it sometime. But yeah, their lawsuit argues that the change violates the New York Constitution and seeks to block the law, which was signed by the governor last year. Oh, I'm sorry, they seek to block the law, not the change. It's a badly written sentence, I'm sorry. The complaint states such consolidation increases the burdens associated with casting a vote, fundraising, and generating support for candidates, among other essential campaigning activities, while contributing to voter fatigue due to higher number of issues and or candidates on the ballot. You know, they're right. I've had that. I've had that issue. I've been voting, and I just all of a sudden get overwhelmed with voter fatigue. Sitting there filling out those little bubbles, and I can do maybe 3-4 tops, but you start getting into, you know, those judges and those county representatives and you know, all the local town people and all that. I have to run out of there screaming. It's too much. Too many decisions. Too much power. Please. Yeah, okay. You can say that there'll be more campaigning for other issues, but you know what you do? You piggyback onto those. And if you're truly a party that is inclusive, people will find common causes and say, hey, I support this local guy, and this local guy supports this state guy, and they support the federal candidate, etc. It's kind of how the whole system works. Why would you be against that? Well, we already explained why, because you're going to lose. Because more people will vote against you than for you. So you got to do everything possible to keep people from voting. Or to make it as difficult as possible or as obscure as possible. All right, well, that's a little bit of progress. I don't know, is that progress or is that regression? I'm not sure. I guess it depends which way the lawsuit goes. But it's just sad that here on Long Island, virtually every form of government is opposed to people voting. Unless the people are voting for them, obviously. But allowing everyone to vote and having more people turn out, they're against that. There's just no other way to phrase it. That is a fact. They are against that. Okay, so we talked last week quite a bit about campus protests. And there's quite a lot of that in the news. It's really blown up. It's really something. Columbia University, my goodness. All kinds of demonstrations going on. And in fact, today, some students took over one of the buildings. Yeah. They actually took over Hamilton Hall on Columbia University campus. This after basically occupying campus, what do you call it, the lawn, the green, whatever it is. They have tents there, and they've been camped out. It's kind of weird, you know, listening to Democracy Now! before us. They're chanting end the occupation while they're occupying Columbia University. I just thought that was kind of funny. Maybe come up with a different chant. Just if you're the occupier of the campus at the moment, just saying it's an easy target for those who are critical. And
they're students.
I know, they're learning.
They're students.
This is part of the learning process, Kyle. Did you demonstrate on campus ever? I have. I'm not trying to make it like I, you know, was Abby Hoffman or anything like that, but there were things that people were upset about, and I held a picket sign every now and then, but, you know, nothing like this. And I went to Washington, D.C. a couple of times in a bus that came from campus, so that sort of counts.
I mean, barely, I guess is what I would say, but Everybody does, you know, get out there and become activated and as a part of whatever their interests are. And sometimes it's on or off campus, wherever you're out there figuring out your own identity and what you're all about, what you want to pursue.
Isn't that what the college experience is supposed to be about? Figuring yourself out, knowing what it is that matters to you and doesn't matter to you, and expressing yourself. And boy, you know, I see that happening right now. And this, friends, this is a – did I just call listeners friends? Boy, it's turning into a sermon, isn't it? No. Sorry. No friends. No, they're friends, of course. They're, we need a better word. Compatriots? Listeners. Yeah, listeners. Okay. Hey, listeners. I forgot what I was going to say. Damn it. Oh, there's a civics lesson going on right now. A massive civics lesson going on throughout the country. It's on your TV sets. It's on your laptops. It's on your phones. It's everywhere. Pay attention to it because you can learn an awful lot by the way the media is handling this. All right? The way the media is handling this, I mean, I can say it's shameful. I can say it's disgusting. I can say it's abhorrent, but it really is fascinating. It's fascinating just to watch how they twist themselves into pretzels to cover the story in a particular way. For instance, there's a headline I'm looking at right now from Newsweek. Yesterday's when does Newsweek come out? Do they even come out? No, they're just a web page now, right? I don't even know. But this is dated yesterday. Iran celebrates pro-Palestinian protests spreading across U.S. colleges. Okay, big deal. Who cares? Who cares if Iran is celebrating protests in a different country? I mean, what if I told you Belarus celebrates Trump running again for president? Does that really matter? Is that really something that's relevant? I mean, I don't think there's a bunch of students right now at Stony Brook or Columbia or University of Texas at Austin saying, what can we do to impress Iran? You know, we really want to get them on our side. Oh, yeah, because there's nothing like a conservative fundamentalist regime that is good for college students in the West. Yeah, that's what we're into. Please. The only reason that headline came out is so that people who aren't really reading the stories can look at that and say, oh, my God, look at those stupid students. They're helping Iran. Well, you know, Iran celebrates a lot of things. A lot of things that this country does. A lot of things this country doesn't do. So to put the responsibility on students who are simply voicing their strong opinion about something, that's not really kosher. No. Not in my view, anyway. But anyway, yeah, so today... It advanced, at Columbia University, it advanced another step. When this building called Hamilton Hall was taken over. Yeah, protesters occupied it this morning, and it's being widely condemned everywhere. White House condemns takeover of Columbia University building. Use of the word intifada at college protests. Okay, what word are they supposed to use exactly? Because... if you're standing up for civilians of a particular country, and that's the word they use to describe standing up for themselves and fighting back, and yes, they do have the right to fight back. You know, if you start outlawing words because you don't like what they signify, that is a step way too far, in my opinion. So I'm looking at all these headlines here. It's really incredible. You think they burn the place to the ground? All these people condemning the takeover of this building. Well, here's something. Here's a bit of interesting news. Also from the New York Times. Hamilton Hall has a long history of student takeovers. Did you know that? 1968. The building, which, by the way, opened in 1907, it was the first building that hundreds of students seized in April of 1968 during protests over the Vietnam War, racism, and Columbia's plans to build a gymnasium in nearby Morningside Park. Students barricaded themselves inside, preventing the acting dean, Henry Coleman, from leaving his office for one night. As demonstrators used furniture to keep Mr. Coleman inside, yeah, protesters who were part of an African-American student group asked white students in the building to leave. That created a separate protest for black students as the white students went on to demonstrate in other buildings on campus. How do you like that? They just went on to protest in other buildings. A week later, the police entered the building through underground tunnels, which somehow were there, and cleared the students. Police officers trampled protesters, hit them with nightsticks, and dragged some down concrete steps. More than 700 people were arrested. During another round of protests in May 1968, about 250 student protesters occupied Hamilton Hall again. The police removed them from the building about 10 hours later. In 1972, students locked themselves in Hamilton Hall, which, by the way, was named after Alexander Hamilton. This occurred during anti-war protests in 1972, as mentioned. Protesters took furniture from classrooms and offices to use as barricades. You don't want to use furniture as barricades. Nail it down. As long as you can pick it up, it's great to use as barricades. Believe me. They also locked doors with chains as administrators told them to leave. Police cleared the building of protesters after about a week, again by entering through an underground passage which for some reason was not blocked, even though they knew this time it was there. No one was injured or arrested. Interesting. But the university said that the students would be prosecuted for criminal trespass and contempt of a court injunction that had forbidden the occupation of Columbia buildings. Then in 1985, protesters padlocked and chained Hamilton Hall as they demanded that the university divest from companies that were doing business in South Africa. The university was reluctant to comply. 3 weeks later, the students ended their blockade just before a judge ordered them to reopen Hamilton Hall. Yeah, we were going to do it anyway, so. While there were no guarantees of any change in policy, the students viewed the protest as a moral victory. And let me just say to anyone out there protesting, thinking of protesting, anytime you protest and it's something you believe in, it's a moral victory. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Later that year, 1985, Columbia's Board of Trustees voted to sell all of the university's stock in American companies doing business in South Africa. Yeah, it worked. 1992, students blockaded Hamilton Hall in protest of Columbia's plans to turn the Audubon Theater and Ballroom, where Malcolm X had been assassinated in 1965, into a biomedical research complex. That blockade lasted less than a day. Yeah, it was the 90s after all. 1996, students demanding the creation of an ethnic studies department at Columbia went on a hunger strike, and about 100 protesters occupied Hamilton Hall for about 4 days in 1996. The university did not meet their demand at the time, but agreed for the first time to provide a physical space for Asian and Hispanic studies programs. 3 years later, the Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race was established. So look, you have a history here of occupying Hamilton Hall. Students today occupied Hamilton Hall. Students at Columbia University know their history. Let's at least give them some credit for that and stop condemning them. They went to the building that has always been occupied during protests. And now they're occupying it. Maybe we should talk to them. Maybe we should listen to them. Instead, what do we have? Well, last week, Speaker Mike Johnson. Yeah, Speaker of the House Mike Johnson. He came to Columbia University. He was allowed on campus for some reason, which I cannot figure out, on the steps of Columbia's law library. Wait a minute. This says Columbia's low library. That can't be right. That's from the New York Times. I'll say it's got to be law library. He was booed and heckled by some onlookers. Now, what do you expect? And he comes to New York. This neo-fascist comes to New York and says there is executive authority that would be appropriate. If these threats are not stopped, there is an appropriate time for the National Guard. We have to bring order to these campuses. Let's start by kicking you off the campus, please. Kicking you out of our city. We do not need these hard-right, neo-fascist Republicans coming to our college campuses and spreading their doctrine of hate and intolerance and just utter ignorance. They would like nothing better than to see a repeat of Kent State. Senators Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Josh Hawley of Missouri, recently called for troops to be sent in to crack down on pro-Palestinian protests on campus. Cotton did the same thing in 2020 when he said military force should be used to put down riots across the country after the civil unrest that followed the death of George Floyd. Not a road you want to go down, but these Republicans are more than happy to do that. And why do we give them the forum on our college campuses? It's disgusting. It really is. And the way this has been dealt with on various college campuses, I mean, I've been watching the news. You hear a lot of things. If you read the stories, you hear how these pro-Palestinian protests are scaring everybody. They're anti-Semitic. They're filled with hate. And you know, that's unacceptable. That's not right. You know, if you hear something anti-Semitic anywhere, including out of the mouths of Republicans, you should condemn it right away. I don't care who you are. I don't care what your position is. That is unacceptable. Here's the thing, though. I keep hearing reports of anti-Semitism, reports of Jewish students feeling uncomfortable. And, you know, I get feeling uncomfortable. I feel uncomfortable myself, just, you know, in a situation that's somewhat tense. But nobody should feel uncomfortable for who they are. That's why I ask, show me. Show me what is happening. So we can point to that. You know, there was one person who was part of the Columbia demonstration that was widely quoted as saying that Zionists should not be allowed to live. Okay, there you go. That is something reprehensible. That person was kicked out of the protest, kicked out of the school, widely condemned. Okay, this is the reaction that you should have for somebody who says something ignorant and hateful like that. And you are going to get people, no matter what side, saying things of that nature. So, okay. What I'm seeing on TV, I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing police moving in. I'm seeing them tackling female professors who aren't doing anything that is in any way causing disruption. I'm seeing peaceful demonstrations that remain peaceful until those same cops come charging in. And you know what? Reading these summaries from the 60s, 70s, looks like the same thing. Looks like the protests were peaceful until the cops came in. Keep the cops away. Let the protests continue. Have a teach-in, whatever it is you do on college campuses, and progress from there. Rather than hurling accusations of people simply for waving a Palestinian flag or using the word intifada or saying they don't want genocide. These are not anti-Semitic remarks. These are not things that should be condemned. What should be condemned are uses of force that are inappropriate. You know, yesterday on CNN, our esteemed Mayor Eric Adams from New York City, was doing an interview, and he said that we will not move in on the university, the Columbia University, unless we are invited in by the president of the university. I want to repeat that. He said, we will not move in to the campus unless the university invites us in. Now, who is Eric Adams? Last I checked, Eric Adams was the mayor of New York City. But what he said yesterday, we will not move in until we are invited. You sound like a cop. You sound like the NYPD. I don't think the mayor moves into college campuses that are having protests. No, police do that. Why are you speaking like a cop? Yeah, I know you used to be a cop. Kind of thought you stopped doing that when you became mayor. But no, you're still a cop. Wow, imagine that. Why did nobody jump on this? It was on CNN yesterday. I've never heard a mayor talk like that before. And I've heard some pretty redneck mayors, but boy.
No, I think what he had said was actually in reference to becoming students, like enrolling in a program, like an evening adult learning program.
Well, he wants to take some classes.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
I think that's what it was.
Oh,
actually, it was
misconfused. Well, okay, you know what? I'm going to let him explain, but, you know, it's the whole thing. The whole thing is just, it's just too much. Okay, I want to read a couple more stories about this. There's so much to talk about here. Nearly 200 protesters arrested on Saturday at Northeastern University, Arizona State University, Indiana University. This story, in the business, we say this story's got legs. And this story has got caterpillar legs. It's, well, and I should probably say millipede legs. A lot of legs. A lot of legs here. It's spreading. It's spreading like wildfire. Colleges across the country are struggling to quell growing pro-Palestinian demonstrations and encampments on campus. Yeah, you see, that's the problem. Colleges are trying to quell demonstrations rather than focusing on what the demonstrations are about. And let's not forget what the demonstrations are about. They're about tens of thousands of innocent civilians being massacred. And you know what? You don't like the word genocide? I'm sorry. I'm sorry you don't like the word genocide. But what do you call it when the estimate is, 2% of the Palestinian population has been wiped out? You know, I know there are people who say, yeah, it's called a good start. Yeah, it's disgusting what people are saying and how they are making rules about what word you can use and what word you can't use. And if you say this word, it means you're being anti-Semitic. How is it being anti-Semitic to say that killing 2% of a population is genocide? I don't get that. I see people who say that, you know what, that's not genocide. What's genocide is what happened on October 7th. That's genocide. And, you know, it makes me just want to say to them, you know what, you can have it both. Well, you can accuse the people who committed the acts on October 7th of genocide, but also be guilty of genocide yourself in your reaction. There's enough genocide to go around for all of us. It's not unique to one side or another. There is no country, there is no race, there is no religion that is incapable of despicable acts. And I think nobody gets that more than the Israeli people. I really think that there are so many people on campuses that are Jewish as well that get this, that understand this. So it's such an insult to see the way the media, to see the way the right wing is blanketly staining this entire reaction as something ugly when it's actually something that is necessary and healthy.
Yeah, the framing actually of the stories from the media is revealing of their reporting tendencies. And the other thing with this, like this coding and grading of words really takes away the point of those learning institutions, which is that speech should be allowed to occur there, especially with students. There should be the opportunity to say what you're passionate about, get your message out there, try to articulate it, but you should also be allowed in some, at least once or twice, to say the wrong thing. Like, policing the very words really takes away the discourse that will have wrong speech in it.
Yeah.
So claiming the correct way of saying everything and just dissecting everything instead of getting the channels of communication full of discourse and disagreement and, you know, opening it up, it closes it down.
I am so glad you said that, because we are way too strict sometimes on condemning people for using the wrong word or the wrong phrase or not getting the point that we want them to get. Look, these are all learning environments. These are all areas where people can talk back and forth and listen to each other, not scream at each other and shut each other out. That's not productive. This is an opportunity to actually change where we are going, and it will change the way this country reacts. It's happened before. I just read a bunch of examples in one building where it happened over the years. So, yeah, the fact that this is spreading all over the place, from campus to campus, that means something. That means something. Okay, so Northeastern in Boston, protesters set up an encampment on the campus's Centennial Common that drew more than 100 supporters. The administration had asked the protesters to leave, but many students did not. Around dawn on Saturday, Massachusetts state police officers arrived at the encampment and began to arrest protesters, putting them in zip-tie handcuffs and taking several tents down. They said they had arrested 102 protesters. It was unclear how many of those arrested were students, but the university said students who showed their university IDs were being released. And I think it is important that students be running the show. On their college campuses, they should be running the show. And, yeah, I hear reports of people from outside joining in protests. Again, that's up to the students if they want that kind of support. But if they want it to be just a student-led thing, that's how it should be run, in my opinion. A Northeastern spokeswoman, Renata Neal, said the demonstration had been infiltrated by professional organizers and that the use of virulent anti-Semitic slurs, including kill the Jews, crossed the line. And again, this is something that we have to condemn as loudly as possible, as quickly as possible, all of us, no matter our background, no matter our religion, country of origin, history, any of that. When somebody says something horrible, kill the Jews? No, not on our watch, not in our name. Kick them out, period. A video appeared to show that it was a pro-Israel counter-protester who used the phrase as part of his criticism of the pro-Palestinian protesters' chants. Whoa, hold on a second. The video appeared to show it was a pro-Israel counter-protester who said kill the Jews. If only I knew it was that easy. You mean all you have to do is go to a protest and chant something you want the other side to say, and the media will report it as if they said it. So if I went to an anti-abortion rally in D.C., and I shouted, we don't care what women think, they're second-class citizens, and they should lose the right to vote next. On NBC News later that night, they're going to say that the anti-abortion people in Washington, D.C. are calling for women to lose the right to vote. That's all it takes. Somebody shows up to a protest and chants something horrible, and that gets attributed to the protesters. It's genius. I never knew you could do that. And get this. The Northeastern spokeswoman, Renata Neal, when confronted with the fact that she said that these virulent anti-Semitic slurs are happening, kill the Jews, crossed the line. Confronted with the fact that, you know what, it was a counter-protester that did this to try and make the protesters look bad. She said, well, any suggestion that repulsive anti-Semitic comments are sometimes acceptable, depending on the context, is reprehensible. What? She stood by her initial comments and said that suggesting that it's sometimes acceptable, depending on the context, is reprehensible. Yes, but the person doing it was not one of the protesters. That's the whole point. But we just choose to ignore that. All right, so how many other instances are there of people committing anti-Semitic acts or saying anti-Semitic slurs who aren't actually part of these protesters? I mean, if we're going to report things, let's at least have facts to back them up. And I'm not saying that's not happening. Of course it is. Of course there are people out there saying horrible things. There are horrible people out there. It's inevitable, and that's why our reaction to it is so important. But you can't just make things up. You can't just wish for the evil people that you want to battle to suddenly materialize in a crowd that you don't understand. And that's what we're seeing in the media. If you look at what the media is reporting, just saying you're pro-Palestinian somehow is a black mark against you. Well, I'm pro-Palestinian, always have been. Why would I be anti-Palestinian? Why would anybody be anti-Palestinian? I'm anti-Hamas, if that matters, but that's not the same thing as Palestinian people. Do people know that? That every Palestinian is not a member of Hamas? That Palestinians probably hate Hamas more than anybody else because they're all up in their business constantly? And they welcome nothing more than to actually get rid of Hamas? Not by wiping out their families in the process, but by intelligently getting them out of the picture. It's the way the Israeli government works is to condemn everything and everybody who has a differing opinion as being an agent of Hamas, and therefore legitimizing whatever efforts they go to wipe them off the face of the earth. And, you know, since apparently Columbia students have been infiltrated by Hamas, and that's what I'm seeing in the media, Hamas approves, they sympathize with Hamas, they're basically Hamas. Well, can Israel simply bomb Columbia now? Because in their eyes, I don't see the difference. They're already going across their border and bombing innocent people, or maybe they're not so innocent. Just one thing I want to touch upon, just to counter a lot of the nonsense that we see. When you think of anti-Semitism, you think of Jewish communities. And if you think of Jewish communities and you live in New York, what do you think of? Well, Williamsburg comes to mind. We've all driven through Williamsburg, pointed out the people wearing the funny outfits. Supposedly back in the 1800s or something like that. Yeah, well, that is a sect, a Hasidic sect, and guess what? That particular sect was founded by this guy named Joel Teitelbaum. And he was well known for his spoken and written opposition to Zionism. He encouraged his followers living in Israel to form self-sufficient communities without assistance from the State of Israel, did not want any official engagement with it. Before World War II, most Hasidic rabbis, as well as many other prominent Orthodox rabbis and leaders, believed that God had promised to return the Jewish people to the land of Israel under the leadership of the Moshiach. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, who would arrive when the Jewish people had merited redemption. And while awaiting the Moshiach, the Jewish people were to perform the mitzvot and were not to antagonize or rebel against the Gentile nations of the world. In the years following the Holocaust, Teitelbaum strengthened this position. In his view, the founding of the modern state of Israel by secular and religious Jews, rather than the Moshiach, violated the Jewish commandment that Jews should wait for the Messiah. He taught that the existence of the state of Israel was actually preventing the Messiah from coming. Now, I'm not reading this to say that it has any valid basis or to say I agree in any sense with it, but this is a demonstration of the fact that the situation is so much more complicated and nuanced than any of us know. And this is only one sect. There's another sect called Nerai Karta, which is a religious group of Haredi Jews founded in Jerusalem, 1938. An active opponent of Zionism, advocates a peaceful dismantling of the State of Israel under the belief that the Jewish people are strictly forbidden from reestablishing sovereignty in the land of Israel until the arrival of the Messiah. This is not something that a tiny amount of people believe in. A lot of people believe this. A lot of Jewish people believe this. It is very complex. So when you go around saying that people who are criticizing what is going on now by the Israeli government, you can't just point a finger and say, oh, you're all anti-Semitic. You know, you're all evil people. It's so much more complex than that. So let's study what is actually happening. What is going on with the military campaign? What's wrong with it? How it can be stopped? How justice can one day prevail, how the state of Israel can exist in peace, and how Palestinians can have a homeland where they're secure as well. You know, it's not inconceivable. It really is not. And the more I see this playing out day after day, the more hopeless it seems. But the one spark of positivity comes from people speaking out against it, especially people who have been there themselves, especially people who are purported to be represented by the state of Israel. If they have the guts to stand up and speak out against this and say, not in my name, then there is hope. And if we can band together with people from all different backgrounds, races, religions, that kind of thing, then there's hope. All right, well, that's going to pretty much do it for the sermon today. I think I'd like to hear opinions, differing opinions. Now, I know, you know, we're not going to solve the Middle East. There's no way we can do that. And I'm no expert, and there's plenty that I get wrong. There's plenty I don't understand. But when you see certain things playing out day after day, you have a pretty good sense of what's right and what's wrong. The way we're treating these students is wrong. And by we, I mean society in general. People simply standing up and saying, I don't believe this is right. Okay, well, let's at least talk with you and address those concerns and see if there's a better way to do something. College is a great opportunity to express yourself, to grow as a person, and to stand up to authority. And anytime I see that happening, I'm inspired. And I don't think there was ever a better song written than the song I'm about to go out with by Phil Oakes from many years ago. Kyle, I'm going to give you a second to say goodnight before I say goodnight.
Yeah, you can even be wrong from time to time, but goodnight for now.
OTW@2600.com. Talk to you next week. Good night.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you've given me a number and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I wish that you'd make up your mind, I wish that you'd decide that I should live as freely as those who live outside. Cause we also are entitled to the rights to be endowed. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, you'd like to be my father, you'd like to be my dad, and give me kisses when I'm good and spank me when I'm bad. But since I left my parents, I've forgotten how to bow. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. And things, they might be different if I was here alone. But I've got a friend or two who no longer live at home. And we'll respect our elders just as long as they allow. That when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I've read of other countries where the students take a stand. They've even helped to overthrow the leaders of the land. Now I wouldn't go so far to say we're also learning how, but when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. So keep right on a-talking and tell us what to do. But if nobody listens, my apologies to you. And I know that you were younger once, 'cause you sure are older now. And when I've got something to
say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. So I'm just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.